Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, any place that has a podcast. And by the way, just a quick heads up, we launched a new newsletter this morning, Morning Shots. It is my first foray into the world of newsletters. We already have two fantastic Bulwark newsletters from Jonathan Last and Jim Swift. Jonathan's comes out midday, Jim Swift in the afternoon. And I'm going to endeavor to get one out early every morning, and it will basically have the format that the first one has, which is quick hits, cheap shots, and deep thoughts. And you can imagine that the cheap shots actually is my favorite part. We're joined by constitutional law professor Kim Whaley again today, one of our Bulwark contributors and favorite podcast guests. And thanks for coming and appreciate it very much, Kim.
So happy to be here, Charlie.
Well, I want to talk about the full-on stonewalling strategy of the White House, the court ruling earlier this week, which was a huge setback for the president. And I was also fascinated by the way the judge linked Donald Trump with arguably one of the worst and most corrupt presidents in American history, James Buchanan, and where we're at on the Mueller test. And I want to get to all that, but I can't move off of what's happening on this issue of the pardoning of war criminals. And we've talked about this several times. The president seems locked in on commuting the sentences or changing the terms of confinement of individuals who are accused of atrocities. And once again, what the president does is, I think, bad enough. But also, it's not just what he does, but what he does to his followers and the way he changes norms, the effect that he has on other people, the coarsening of the culture, so that you knew that the moment that Donald Trump began referring to some of these war criminals as American heroes, you knew that there was going to be the domino effect and that the usual suspects would come up. Now, of course, we're now finding out that certain Fox News personalities have been actually lobbying him on all this. So it's kind of a feedback loop. But I wanted to play this soundbite from our old friend Tommy Lahren, who apparently has a show of her own. And she was on Fox and Friends touting her interview with the families of two of these individuals who she keeps referring to as our American war fighters. And I want you to hear how they're framing this on Fox News right now.
Well, I actually had the pleasure of sitting down with the wife and brother of Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher some months back, as well as Julie Goldstein, who I know is a favorite of your show as well. And I did an in-depth interview series with both families talking about their cases. And because this is such a hot topic right now, I encourage everyone to go on and watch it, right, Hear the true story and the whole story before they make their judgments on these two great American heroes.
Yeah, they're believing, they believe the wrong story. They've been people who are critical of Eddie Gallagher and Sean Gallagher have not listened to their side of the story. And for Hillary Clinton to make that conclusion is abhorrent.
Well, it just shows where their priorities are. It's always been terrorists over American warfighters. Right. But thankfully, we have a president who believes the opposite, and he's going to fight for our American heroes.
Right, and they're going to go to trial. So he's going to go through the trial. They just want to make sure how they're housed leading up to that trial. It shouldn't be in solitary confinement. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you, Tommy. Good to see you.
Check it out.
Thank you, guys.
FoxNation.com.
Now, again, this is one of those moments where you need to go back and say, who are we actually talking about here? Who are these American heroes? Look, the American heroes are the Navy SEALs that turn these guys in. I mean, there's Eddie Gallagher, who was described by his own, his fellow SEALs as an out-of-control killer. Mona Chern wrote about this for us last week. He's an out-of-control killer who shot women and old men as well as combatants. In one case, he's accused of stabbing an already severely wounded 15-year-old kid to death. And then he texted photos of the kill and held this reenlistment ceremony. He also, as a sniper said, that he saw Gallagher shoot a 12-year-old girl in a flower print dress who was walking with some of her friends. And it was the Navy SEALs who, at great risk of themselves, came forward. The other guy, Ms. Matt Goldstein, maybe a somewhat tougher case. But he also is accused of killing a suspected Taliban bomb maker under interrogation, a case of flat-out murder. But it's interesting how this is now being cast as, you know, you're either with the terrorist or you're with our brave war fighters. And once again, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, Kim, but once again, you see this coarsening of our culture and the shifting of norms, because frankly, one of the greatest ways of respecting our military is to understand that they do operate by a code of honor. And it does the military no favors to basically say, yeah, we're going to look the other way if you ignore that code of honor.
Yeah, it's rather grotesque. And we have to keep in mind, as you mentioned, you know, people in the military have not only a code of honor, but they're used to following norms, they're used to rules, they're used to accountability. And this is just again another message from the president that traditional rules of accountability are out the window. What really matters is loyalty to me personally. And historically, the pardon power, as people know, is fairly broad. You can't, I think, the accurate reading of it is that it can't be exercised in a way that's unconstitutional. But traditionally, presidents wait until they're sort of lame ducks between administrations where there isn't really political accountability for them to start using this pardon power. It's kind of this a gray area where they can't really be pinged for making decisions that are offensive to the rule of law. And this president doing it in the midst of his presidency, on the cusp of the next election. And what we're seeing on so many fronts, including this, is a steady accumulation of power in the presidency, in the office of the presidency, not just with respect to Mr. Trump. And so it's something everyone should be concerned about across the board, regardless of political party.
You know, it is interesting you mentioned that, because you have a lot of conservatives that define their conservatism as being for small government and getting power out of Washington, and yet they apparently have no problem whatsoever with this concentration of power. But also it is the way he's exercising. And we have a very interesting piece up today at The Bulwark by Robert Trusinski, who comes up with this unified field theory of he calls it the unified field theory of the deplorables. Why does Trump do what he does, and how Trump really sees things in sort of this that he's the leader of the tribe and these are the people that he's supposed to defend, even though he really doesn't understand how the military operates. This is the way he thinks it should. So it's definitely a good read. And then Jonathan Last had a great piece yesterday about Donald Trump and Honor. I usually don't read these pieces, but he said, you know, here are the differences between our guys and the bad guys. The other guys kill women, children, and civilians indiscriminately. American soldiers put themselves at risk in order to not harm innocent non-combatants. The other guys mutilate the bodies of fallen enemies for fun. American soldiers treat even their dead enemies with respect. The other guys take joy from killing their enemies, doing things, for instance, like posing for photos with severed head. American soldiers view hurting their enemies as a professional obligation, not personal recreation. And the thread running through all of this is honor. And it's honor that sets American fighting men and women apart. And boy, you sure don't get that sense now from either the president or his supporters. Okay, so Kim, let's now switch into the legal world, because it's been a very, very interesting week. Let's start with the ruling earlier this week by a federal judge that basically ruled against the president and his associates, who were trying to block a House subpoena of some of his financial records. Give me your take on that, because that was a significant setback for the president and sort of the, you know, maybe the first in what will be a series of judicial rulings on the limits of congressional power to investigate this president.
Well, the White House is saying that it's going to appeal this, but I read that opinion and I think it's close to impossible to see that there'd be a reversal. Essentially, what the judge said was that if the accountability for the presidency through impeachment lies with Congress, it's inconceivable that Congress wouldn't have the ability to investigate that would kind of fall within that umbrella. I mean, it's a very well-reasoned opinion, and I think in other times, these are arguments that most White Houses, most executive branch lawyers wouldn't even dare to make. This is essentially an all-out assault on any accountability through the legislative branch. And now it's going to the judicial branch. And essentially, this judge said, no way. A. B, it's not really up to judges to decide whether what Congress is doing is legitimate. It's not up to the executive branch to decide that. Congress has a broad scope of power. They've given up a lot of it, I think, historically Congress has. But this is pretty easy. And I think we will see more and more of this shifting to the federal courts. And I think even having worked with Justice Kavanaugh earlier in his career, I think even conservative judges who are intellectually honest will agree pretty clearly that this assault on any accountability from Congress is just flat out wrong as a matter of core constitutional principles.
I thought his language was very strong. The judge who wrote, it is simply not fathomable that a constitution that grants Congress the power to remove a president for reasons including criminal behavior would deny Congress the power to investigate him for unlawful conduct past or present, even without formally opening an impeachment inquiry.
Sure. I mean, that I think this is a little bit of the rub, and we're getting into impeachment here. The idea, well, does Nancy Pelosi have to start impeachment to make all of these investigations legitimate? And the judge said no. I mean, let's go back to the Emoluments Clause, which was, you know, kind of brought up a couple of years ago early in the administration. We've gone well beyond that as being kind of the hot button issue. But the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution doesn't say that the president can't take gifts from foreign foreign countries. What it says is the Congress can authorize the president to take, this is my language, but essentially says Congress can bless gifts to the president from foreign countries. But it basically gives that authority to the Congress. It's not about banning something outright from the president. So the idea is, if the Constitution contemplates that Congress has the ability to basically allow certain gifts, certainly Congress has the ability to decide to gather facts, to make that determination as to whether the president can accept gifts from foreign entities. I mean, that's just one kind of little sort of angle. But I think broadly speaking, this president is taking the position that there's essentially no legitimate oversight. And the court was like, that's just beyond the pale.
I wrote about this yesterday. I was fascinated by the judge's comparison of Trump's arguments to James Buchanan's argument, that James Buchanan essentially made the same case that the Congress shouldn't be able to investigate him, that it was just simply sort of, you know, presidential harassment. Of course, Buchanan being one of the worst presidents in American history. But it's interesting little historical footnote that, in fact, that investigation that Buchanan was objecting to actually had a lot of it was quite consequential. It was known as the, I think I can pronounce this correctly, but then who will know, the Kavod Committee, after its chairman. And it produced this detailed report exposing a lot of the corruption of the Buchanan administration and his fellow Democrats, bribery, disenfranchisement of voters, abuse of printing contracts, subsidies for partisan presses from public accounts. And this was released in June of 1860 in the middle of the presidential campaign that Abraham Lincoln went on to win. And it was very, very damaging to Democrats' prospects, even though Buchanan himself wasn't running. Detailed accounts of Democratic corruption, which circulated, you know, throughout the North, gave Republicans in the Lincoln campaign, a very, very strong case of basically saying, look, these Democrats are rotten and dishonest and ought to be thrown out of office. So in a lot of ways, it's an interesting historical example of how a congressional investigation can have tremendous political consequences even without an impeachment inquiry.
Well, and even without a legislative purpose. I mean, the other thing the judge does is says, you know, not only does Congress have authority to investigate for purposes of legislating, which I think is kind of the primary justification for investigative. But the judge says, you know, Congress also has a public information role and a public information exposure obligation. Can't do it just to score political points, can't kind of, to use a hackneyed phrase, go on witch hunts. But certainly the oversight role of Congress includes letting the public know what's going on in the other branch, even if that doesn't actually produce legislation. The White House is making an argument that really, really shackles Congress's authority to investigate as somehow having to be proven or tied to directly to some legislation. And there just really isn't any legal or historical authority for that. I mean, for lawyers, you know, you could really go and make the argument. I teach civil procedure, and one of the rules of civil procedure is you can't make frivolous arguments in court. There, you can actually be sanctioned for making arguments that are so off the, you know, off the deep end. But that's really where we are. We have to have the federal judges now come in and reestablish core principles, because, as you say, they're really getting distorted in you know, some of the outlets. And most Americans just don't understand core constitutional concepts.
Well, here's the, seems to be the big question. I think you touched on this, because there's a lot of argument. There's a lot of people making the argument that House Democrats need to open the impeachment inquiry in order to give them the power to get testimony and to get evidence that they want, and that short of this, they're going to continue to be stonewalled. This decision seems to suggest, I think that's what you mentioned before, seems to suggest that no, Congress still should be able to get this information without an impeachment inquiry. So, I mean, that's got to be the debate going on within House Democrats right now. You know, are you being forced by the stonewalling of the White House? Are you being being forced to go to an impeachment inquiry?
And that's a good, maybe it seems like the White House could arguably be way overplaying its hand here, because Congress is fighting for the viability of itself as an institution. So this is going to go to the courts. The courts are slow. It can ask for expedited review. And maybe, I mean, politically, this is not a legal question. Politically, maybe the White House is gambling that impeachment is good for them for 2020. I really don't know. But I do believe, whether it's through the court system, I guess is tier one, or through impeachment, Congress has to protect its institutional prerogative. And unfortunately, today, that's just the Democrats. The Republicans are willing to get on the Trump bandwagon, regardless, as your opening remarks say, regardless of how grotesque and horrific supporting this president really means as a matter of just basic human principles, principles of humanity, let alone legal concepts.
Well, let's talk about the Don McGahn stonewall, which we may look back on and say that this was the tipping point. This was the turning point where House Democrats did begin to push for impeachment. The White House seems to be sketching out a really absolutist position, that there is this blanket immunity, not just for people who are serving in the White House, but who have formerly served in the White House. So you mentioned that the White House may be overplaying its hand. This seems to be a very extreme position that they're taking.
Sure. They're saying that there is an absolute immunity for aides to the president that is even broader than executive privilege. We've heard a lot about executive privilege. So that essentially, the idea is none of this is expressed in the Constitution, but the idea is there's certain things the president should be able to keep confidential, or he or she can't make good decisions with his closest aides, because they know that's going to become public. And then that hurts the populace, because the president can't make good decisions. So executive privilege is not a blanket privilege. It means it's kind of like the attorney-client privilege. You know, it's a topic by topic privilege. So someone, say McGahn, would go before the Congress. A member might ask a question, and McGahn would talk to his own lawyers and say, you know what, I'm not going to answer that, because that particular thing is covered. That very specific topic is covered by executive privilege. But he still has to show up and answer the questions, and then kind of raise roadblocks one by one. Essentially, the president and the White House are taking the position, there's something even bigger than that. There's a full-scale immunity that derives from presidential immunity for his close aides. So there are these doctrines that essentially say you can't sue a judge for doing judgy things. You can't sue a judge for sentencing someone a certain way. You can't sue a member of Congress for voting in a particular way on legislation. You can't sue the president for acting in his presidential capacity, because if that were the case, government really wouldn't function. So that's known as an absolute immunity. It's not completely fail-safe, but essentially this president's saying that absolute immunity sort of bleeds out into his close advisors, not just while these advisors are in office, but even when they leave office. So now McGahn is a private citizen. He's saying the president's own absolute immunity from making presidential decisions goes to his close advisors when those advisors are even in the private sector. And, you know, this is essentially the president speaking through his own lawyers as advocates for him. The law, the one decision, I think it's from 2008 from Judge John Bates, my former colleague from the Mueller Whitewater investigation. Actually, he was my boss at DOJ as well. Very, very thoughtful, brilliant jurist. basically rejected this very argument under the Bush White House and said, no, actually, that's not how even absolute immunity works for the president. It's never absolute, and it's not absolute for former counsel and for former counsel. That basically what this White House is saying, yeah, well, that decision wasn't appealed. Something was worked out. But I think we all have to go back to first principles. Again, it's consistent with the decision on Monday. Nobody is above a law, and Congress has legitimate oversight prerogatives. I mean, those are two foundational bedrock principles of our constitutional democracy, our three-branch government. There's no one's the boss of all the bosses. And that's really being tested right now in ways that are quite disturbing.
Well, in one way it's being tested, of course, is the subpoena for the request. I don't know if it's a subpoena. It's a letter from the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee to the IRS exercising his statutory authority to get a copy of Donald Trump's tax forms. And the Treasury Department is basically saying, yeah, no, we're not going to give it to you really under any circumstances. And now we find out that there was a confidential internal IRS memo saying, look, you don't have any discretion. You know, this is black law. But so where are we at on that? The memo did say that unless the president asserts executive privilege for his own individual taxes, they're going to have to turn them over.
And executive privilege, as I mentioned before, that would have to be these documents relate to, you know, confidential deliberations that I'm having as president. It's hard to imagine that his personal tax returns would fall within that. But this raises two issues. One is, in that context, there's a statute passed by Congress that essentially makes this stuff, it's a lay down that he has to turn it over statutorily. It's not even a constitutional question. There's a statute. Now, the president could go and IRS could go and say, listen, we want to challenge the statute is constitutional, but that's the law of the land. And you don't get to pick and choose as a member of the executive branch whether to comply with a statute. But the other thing that this uncovers is sort of the distinction between lawyers acting as political kind of bulldogs for the president and sort of career lawyers. So I worked in the Justice Department. I worked for the Federal Trade Commission. I worked for Ken Starr. I was a clerk to a federal judge. I had a fairly, I think, broad career as a federal employee. And most lawyers in the federal government really go in, they take an oath of office, and they go in to apply the law and the facts straight up. You know, you don't get to say as a client to, and when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office, a federal employee or one of my clients couldn't come to me and say, you know what, I want you to do X. I want you to fight this all the way. We would say, you know what, as an institution, a government institution, we're not going to make that argument. We're not going to because we are officers of the law. That's very different from someone in private practice. You know, if your client says, you know, I want you to go all the way with this, you do it. And here we've got career Treasury lawyer saying, no, this is obvious. The statute is binding. And then we have the president's kind of political government and employees saying, we're going to challenge that. And I think that break, we saw this, I think, a little bit with Barr, with Attorney General Barr, we're seeing this, that break between, you know, lawyers and government officials as essentially advocates of this personal president and lawyers and government officials, someone like Mueller, someone like Rosenstein, being really officers of the law and the institution, that distinction is breaking down. And I think it's something we need to pay attention to.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the most important norms, especially when you have the president very openly urging his attorney general to investigate or prosecute his political enemies and basically be his Roy Cohn. Now, I mean, this could really end up being a real legal showdown, because if in fact, Steven Mnuchin and the Trump appointed head of the IRS just simply say, there's no way we're ever giving you the taxes, no matter how many court cases you win, we're gonna run out the clock, because they seem to have really settled into, there's no way on earth that we're ever going to show these. And I thought, in my newsletter this morning, I linked to Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post, who has a series of questions about this. And she said, here's the basic question. I mean, why exactly is Trump and the rest of his administration expending so much energy and political capital to keep these documents secret? I mean, what is there? You know, what could possibly be so disturbing or incriminating to justify such an effort? And of course, we don't know the answer, but there's lots of interesting theories.
And I think that question still looms even over the Mueller investigation and the Russia interference in the 2016 election. Why did so many people on Team Trump in the campaign lie about their contacts with the Russians if it wasn't such a big deal? I mean, this is just a matter of human nature and psychology. You know, if you've got nothing to lose to tell the truth, you tell the truth. If there's a reason that the truth is going to hurt you, you lie about it. But I think there's probably two fronts going, you know, here. One might be something that the president doesn't want to make public. And two is just really saying, make me. I'm not complying with the law. I'm not complying with traditional norms. I'm going to amass as much power until someone puts up a roadblock. And right now, there haven't been effective roadblocks. And we have a court order. They're going to appeal the court order with respect to the tax returns. If that's affirmed, which I think it will be, you know, unless there's a judge that's willing to go off the rails, which they have life tenure for a reason, because they're not politically sort of vulnerable, then the question will be, is this administration going to comply with the Article III judicial branch of our Constitution? Or are they going to say, we don't care what a court order says, we don't care what a court says? And then we're getting into what we are also talking about, this concept of contempt. How do you enforce contempt? You put people in jail. You know, it's kind of like make me, you know, how far is this going to go? You know, we've seen this on the school playgrounds, or, you know, anyone who's a parent, you know, the kid says, I'm not going to do X. And then you have to take away phones. You got to put them in timeouts. There has to be a consequence. And I think that's what we're seeing on a macro constitutional level in government right now.
No, and it's certainly possible that we'll get those tax reform, those tax returns through some other source, you know, for maybe New York State or maybe the subpoena of the financial records. But, you know, part of me is so cynical that whatever they discover in there, it won't move the needle. I mean, at this point, we really ought to recognize that nothing really matters. But this question of the rule of law and whether or not he's going to follow, I think, is central. Now, you mentioned the Mueller investigation. We're now getting reports that Bob Mueller is not, or at least, you know, is allegedly not that anxious to testify, that he's concerned about being politicized. Now, you know, I think this is a good point to remind everybody that a lesson we ought to have learned is that nobody knows what Robert Mueller is thinking or what he's actually doing. But I guess I find it a little bit surprising that that we're hearing that he's not necessarily anxious to testify about this, because I'm thinking that after all of the time that he spent on this and all of the misrepresentation of his work and all of the pushback, that he would want to tell that story. But then again, I don't know Bob Mueller.
I don't know Bob Mueller either. He's the mystery man. You know, he's the man behind the curtain. I would agree with you that the way that things unfolded with this attorney general in terms of disclosing the report would be of deep concern. And Mueller himself signed the letter to the attorney general. The attorney general said it must have been some minion who did it, you know, got snitty about it. But Mueller signed the letter saying, listen, I'm really worried about how this is being distorted. I mean, the whole point of appointing Mueller was to have an independent entity doing this investigation and drawing conclusions so the American public could buy into it across the board as an apolitical sort of process. That's the whole point. And in Barr coming in and kind of making it political at the 11th hour, it does sort of undercut all of that work. It's really hard to know. I mean, and Mueller has taken, I think, some criticism for not making a call on obstruction. But where I'm sitting, I when people adhere to their principles and adhere to ethics and integrity and neutrality and the facts and the law, I'm not in a position to criticize that, even if it means some consequences that we're not comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that inevitably he's going to have to testify at some point. But I think, you know, this is what's going on. Again, going back to what we talked about before, whether Democrats actually need to start the impeachment inquiry to get all the things that they need. I think, and I think you agree, that based on the court rulings, they don't need to have impeachment to get the testimony of people like Bob Mueller. But who knows? You know, we've never seen a president, have we, who basically has taken this absolutist stonewalling approach to a co-equal branch of government.
No, this is a full out, you know, like I said, make me. I mean, this is just really the legal arguments they're making, the constitutional arguments that they're making would reconstruct, if successful, would literally transform the nature of our government and make Congress this weakling add-on to whoever's in the White House. And that should be of deep concern to everyone, because autocracies are generally not great for individual rights. That's kind of can be taken to the bank. And if you enhance the power of the presidency, that mantle goes to the next person in office, which in our current political climate, you know, I just don't think there's any guarantees what this electorate will do in the future. And the most that this president can get is 4 more years. Even if he gets reelected, he's out in 8. And then that presidency, that sort of, as I said, mantle of massive power passes to who knows who. And that's deeply concerning. It's almost more concerning right now to me as a sort of constitutional scholar, what's happening to government than it was even 6 months or a year ago when we were really talking about Russia and obstruction of justice, which is still out there as non-addressed, frankly. This is not an all or nothing proposition. There's evidence of obstruction. There's evidence of, collusion, frankly, which is not a legal term, but it's out there, and that's just kind of everyone's shrugging. It's a big shrug.
Yeah.
And that's not okay.
Well, you use an interesting phrase there, that Congress would be reduced to a weakling add-on, and they apparently are okay with this, or are acting as if they're okay with this, which continually surprises me, because you would think, and I think that the authors of the Federalist Papers just simply assumed that there would be a certain, you know, jealous guarding of power and prerogatives, and that Congress would never, you know, cede its authority so willingly. But I mean, this has been happening for many, many years, but it does seem to be accelerating. And I'm also surprised that there's not more anxiety among the conservatives in Congress, who are recognizing that, you know, with each step of presidential power enhancement, it's going to make it that much harder to stop the next Democratic president. And the Democratic candidates are already being very open, saying, you know, I will use my executive authority to enact this, you know, whether it's on climate change or on health care or gun control. And you know that, I mean, I take them at their word, and I think that they're in earnest. And I think that Republicans are going to have a very, very hard time making a strong case against them if they actually feel they need to make cases anymore, as opposed to just simply tribally opposing them, having looked the other way and turned themselves into weakling add-ons during the Trump years.
Yeah, I mean, it's human nature. And as you mentioned, the framers know this. People amass power. They don't like to give it up. No one likes to give up power. It's not Democrat or Republican thing. And I think there's two pieces here that framers also, and even the Supreme Court, I think assumed that whoever gets to the office of the presidency is going to respect norms and will have, you know, basic competency and basic sort of the judicious, measured approach to respect for the institution. So we're in, you know, la la land in that regard with respect to this president, and he's willing to bully anyone. The one Michigan House member who has defied him within 48 hours already has a primary challenger. So the idea is, listen, if you challenge me, you know, I'm going to crush you. And so that could be one motivating factor. And I also think the other thing people are just sort of saying is, well, you know, this is temporary. We'll get back to normal at some point. And I think what you and I are saying, Charlie, is don't be so complacent about that. What I tell people is, when the stormtroopers are at your back door because your political views or your race or your religion isn't, you know, in line with whoever happens to be in power at that point, it's too late to grab back your own rights.
Well, and, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, people may think that that's going too far, but, you know, there is a price to be paid for constantly, you know, talking about locking your political opponents up and throwing words like treason around. You know, this new culture where it's not just simply enough to out-argue or defeat your opponent at the ballot box. You must destroy them as a human being. You must destroy them and destroy their families and perhaps take away their freedom. That's a dangerous turn in politics. And I think we know where that leads.
Sure. I mean, that kind of power. I mean, we see what was happening with this president, with Mr. Joe Biden's son. You know, let's start investigating my political opponents. That happens in, and I know it sounds extreme, but that happens in parts of the world where there aren't the kinds of freedoms we have in America. And I think we're all very, very complacent that we have a birthright to free speech, a birthright to due process, that, you know, people don't go to jail based on their political views. People, you know, there have to be, you know, facts and law that apply, and that that are they're adhered to. We have neutral judges. We have, you know, ideally neutral prosecutors. All these things, you know, people violate the laws. There's consequences. People respect court orders. All of these things that we just take for granted can't be taken for granted, I think, forever.
Well, and if we're in a post-shame culture as well, when we, you know, spend the first couple of years talking about being a post-truth culture, you know, what happens, you know, in terms of, yes, there should be legal consequences, but what happens when you have political leaders who are utterly shameless? And I've said this before, Donald Trump's superpower is his shamelessness. Now, speaking of which, this may be a totally unfair segue, but breaking news as we're talking, you know, the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, who clearly made one of the best decisions of the year, and just, I mean, wait for this now, by not resigning after that, the scandal about posing in blackface blew up. Everybody thought he was dead man walking. Everybody assumed that he was going to be out within a couple of hours. And Jonathan Last did a piece for The Bulwark where he sort of gamed it out, and he said, you know, in the modern political world, there's really no reason for the governor to fall on his sword. You know, he's probably better off just brazening it out. I mean, look what Clinton did. Look what, you know, how Trump handles all of these things. And sure enough, he's brazens it out. He's still at like a 40% approval rating. And now we have this this investigation that is inconclusive about who, in fact, is in that photo. So once again, the, you know, an indication kind of how the rules are changing, that scandals or controversies that would have ended someone's political career 5 minutes ago. Yeah, just hang on. Just wait a little while. Let the news cycle go and you're going to be standing.
And it's hard to really identify where's the boundary now. Where's the boundary between, you know, all of these jobs are not an entitlement. It's like any job. We've all had jobs that, you know, they're good people in the job, or good people that do a good job and people that don't. And if you don't do a good job, you might get fired or you might not, you know, get the promotion. And I think that's the standard that should apply to our elected leaders, because we, in theory, our constitutional government is set up so that the people are the bosses of the government, not the other way around. And if there are no limits, if the standard is, listen, there isn't proof of a felony, so this president stays in, then there aren't any boundaries. Then pretty much anything goes. And that's a scary prospect. And I should add, you mentioned the sort of post-truth culture. We're in a world with technology, with Rod Rosenstein mentioned this publicly, with the, you know, the idea of deepfakes, that technology can literally create you know, sound bites, videos of politicians saying incriminating things that are 100% manufactured. And so the big question is sort of like a kind of an existential question. How do we move forward, even if we do care, even if we do think there should be boundaries, there are red lines? How do we know the red line has actually been crossed?
Well, you know, and this whole deep fake, and it's out there, and people are probably nodding their heads going, yeah, deep fakes are a big problem. I think people have no idea. I mean, I lived through the 2015-2016 cycle where we watched this massive flood of false information and hoaxes, and how difficult it was to push back and how quickly they can disseminate. You know, the worst stories on Facebook, I mean, the most, you know, false stories on Facebook were shared more often than, I mean, more widely than true stories. But we haven't seen, you know, when you start to have videos and the level of the sophistication of these videos is ramping up. You know, you will see someone saying something, you know, Joe Biden, you know, endorsing the Taliban, or I don't know what. I mean, you know, somebody endorsing pedophilia, and you'll see them say it. You'll see their lips move. You will actually be able to watch them do something. And, you know, by the time people figure out that it's not true, it will have done tremendous damage. And then, of course, there are people in bad faith who will never acknowledge that it's not true. And then the flip side is, That once you have a number of these hoaxes, people, even if you do catch somebody on tape committing some transgression, people won't believe it. There will be no evidence that will be able to convince someone that something is true or not true. And that then we're in an era where you do have what I think you know, it's been described as the annihilation of truth. Hannah Arendt described this as the annihilation of truth.
And then whoever is your leader, whatever comes out of that person's mouth becomes the truth. I mean, this is how, you know, Russia manages its population through the media, right? I mean, they that's the kind of thing. And then if your ability to think is distorted, then that's really where freedoms go. And I think what we're saying is, even if we can't make a determination as to truth and fact, what I tell my own children is, every day we should live every day with integrity and a sense of our core value system. That's the lighthouse that will guide us through life. And that's really lost in politics right now. I mean, that's, we talked about, you know, starting from the beginning of this conversation, this idea of basic sort of guardrails of humanity and treating people with respect. If that's just not valued because our tribe is the one in power, we want to keep our tribe in power, then we're lost as a culture. We're lost as a society.
Yeah, and I think we're – so on that, you know, before I say anything more negative, on that really depressing note, I actually I have a copy of Peter Weiner has a new book out that's supposed to be very, very hopeful, you know, the how we recover our democratic values, which I think I'm going to have to sit down and read. It's not coming out till next month when your book comes out, but I'm going to have to read it to get a little bit more hopeful because I do take that darker view that we have a society of people who are now prepared to sort of shrug their shoulders. Who knows what's true? Who knows who to believe? I might as well just simply choose sides and go with whatever my tribe and the leader of my tribe happens to say. Kim Whaley, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate your time and your insight, and we'll look for all of your contributions. Kim is a constitutional law professor, author of a book on the Constitution coming out next month, How You Should Read the Constitution and Why You Should Read the Constitution, correct?
How to Read the Constitution and Why with Harper Collins. June 25th, yeah.
And is a contributor to The Bulwark. So thanks for coming in. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.